my name is Peggy, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. This is probably one of my least favorite things to do. I do get very, very nervous. Paul asked me, why didn't you tell me you didn't want to do this? And I said, well, my sponsor has always told me you never refuse a commitment. And I also know that when I am very uncomfortable, God's got something to work with. So let's hope he does a good job this day. I do want to thank Paul for asking Matt and I to come to Oklahoma City. This is our third trip here. It is one of our favorite places to come. The people in Oklahoma are so wonderful. You have the biggest hearts, and we love being here. We wish we could take you all back to California. You can keep your weather here, but we'd like to take you all back to California with us because you are just truly very hospitable people, and we really like Oklahoma City a lot. I was born and raised in Arizona. Yuma, Arizona, if you don't know where that is, it sits on the border of California and Mexico, and my dad came from a long line of farmers, and I grew up on a farm, and my dad was a very, very busy man. He not only farmed, he ran two cotton gins, and I don't know if my dad was an alcoholic, but what I do know is that my dad drank a lot. And what happened when he got home is my mom really reacted to his drinking. And he would walk in the door. He might be drunk. He might have just been working really late because he did that when it was ginning season. And she'd be yelling and screaming at him. And those are the things that I learned, and those are the things that I picked up and I carried with me. And, and I still carry them with me. Recovery is a process, thank goodness, because there's many days that I still fall down, but I get to, get back up and try it again. I have one sister. I'm the only person in my family that's in recovery. My sister has always struggled with her weight. To this day, she's very overweight. She works many, many hours. She's in a marriage where she and her husband have a king-sized bed, and between them, three cocker spaniels sleep. And I'm the one that has all the problems. And my mom and dad divorced after 39 years of marriage, and she remarried a man. I don't really know him all that well because I don't live in Yuma anymore. And but every time we go to their house, they've got a refrigerator outside that's stocked full of beer. And I don't know if he's got a drinking problem or not, but I just know what I see. And it doesn't sound like, that my mom's gone from anything different from my dad to the man she's married to today. I get so, there's so many things I want to share, but I want to get to my recovery, and I always forget to check what time it is, too. There was a lot of stuff that, got pretty crazy. The older I got, the crazier it seemed to get at home. It really got bad when my dad had his first heart attack. I was not quite 16 years old, and he suffered a massive heart attack. If he hadn't been in the hospital when he had it, he would have died. And he wasn't able to do the things that he had always done around the house, and being the oldest, a lot of those responsibilities were left to me. And the caretaking, starting to do things around the house and helping to take care of my sister, who was only 18 months younger than I was. I don't really know why I had to take care of her, but, they started pretty early. My mom started working when I was about 10 years old, and so I learned to cook. I went to 4-H, and I had a lot of fun doing that, and I loved to cook, and so I started cooking, and I started doing that for the family, and like I said, my sister had weight problems, and my dad was obsessed with them, and he would send her, he made her take dancing lessons so that maybe that would help her lose weight. He even had her on prescription speed at one time. you know, he was taking her to a doctor that would prescribe diet pills for her, and she took those. And then Weight Watchers came around, and she did that, and it was my responsibility to make sure that she ate what she was supposed to. And one of the things that she had to eat was liver once a week. And I don't like liver. She doesn't like liver. None of us like liver. And if you like liver, that's more power to you. There's a lot out there for you to eat. So I would have to cook it for her, and then I would have to cut it up into little bite-sized or pear-sized pieces so that she could just swallow them. I still don't understand why I had to do that. She could have done it, but, you know, it was my responsibility. And like I said, after my dad had that heart attack, things were just pretty crazy, and, you know, I was really wanting to get out of the house. And, of course, when you're a teenager, you think you know it all, and parents are stupid, and they don't know anything, and I know that because we have a teenager at home. And I got pregnant when I was 17, and that in those days, you did get married, and so that's what we did. We got married. And about 2 weeks after we got married, I had a miscarriage, and we moved over to Indio, California, which is near Palm Springs. I don't know if any of you know where that is, but it's one of the armpits of the nation. I know there's a lot of them, but it's one of them. And we've been married for, I don't know, a month or so, and I was being the dutiful little wife, doing the Donna Reed thing, getting up in the morning, fixing his breakfast, making his lunches so that he could go off and go to work. And this one morning, I don't know where it came from, I don't know what I did, I don't know what I said, but he just beat me up. Before he went to work, I guess that's what he felt like doing. And I did not understand that. I didn't know where it came from. I had never been physically abused. But it set up that thing for me that was like, if I only did this when he came home, then I wouldn't get hit. If I only cooked a certain meal, then when he came home, I wouldn't get hit. If the house looked a certain way when he came home, then I wouldn't get hit. You know, it was, what was I doing wrong? Why didn't he love me for who I was? Why did I have to get hit? And so I was the one that was wrong. I was the one that was doing something. And I was also very arrogant and had an extreme amount of pride, and I was not going home, and I was not going to tell my family that this was happening. But it's awfully strange that they always know. People always know what's going on. And even though I didn't live in the same town, my parents knew what was going on. And we joined the Army, and we moved to Texas for a while. And now I'm really away from everybody. And I really thought now things would be different, and they weren't. And we went back home for Christmas, and I didn't go back. I was 18 years old, and I haven't seen that man since. I divorced him through the mail, and I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. But I don't know whether he was an alcoholic or not either. You know, we were pretty young, and he drank, but he didn't, as far as I know, what I know today, he didn't drink alcoholically. But I had this huge hole in my soul that I didn't know about at that time. And the only way I knew how to make it feel better was to find another him. And in Arizona at that time, the drinking age was 19, and most of the hims were in the bars, and so that's where I started going when I turned 19. And, you know, I was always looking for him, and I finally found another one and got married again when I was 20. And things were going pretty good. We partied a lot. We drank a lot. And then there would always come a time for me where, okay, well, you know, we've had enough fun now. We've got to stop drinking. It's time to settle down. and get on with life. And I couldn't understand for him why every time we went somewhere we had to have an ice chest full of beer in the car. And we had a ski boat, and we'd go out on the Colorado River on the weekends, and I couldn't understand why we always had to take, if we were going to go for the whole day, why we had to take a whole case, and if we were going for the weekend, why we had to take two or three cases. I never understood that, you know? And thank goodness today we just travel with an ice chest full of Pepsi. But, so I thought, well, we'll have a child. That'll fix this need that I have, you know, to be loved. And he didn't really want any kids, and I did. And I know how to con and manipulate pretty good. I'm a pretty good controller. And so we had a little boy. And I just had a grandchild from my son. Well, he didn't have it, but his girlfriend did. And the whole time I was there, while that baby was being born, which was just a week ago, I remembered when my son was born, because he's 21. His dad was never in the room. If my mom hadn't been there, I would have been there all by myself. And my son stayed in that room with his girlfriend the whole time. And I was so proud of him, you know, and he was loving on her and making her feel okay. And all I could think about was when he was born and how much, looking back on it, it hurt. But, you know, there was a lot of drinking, and I just didn't want to live the way we were living anymore. And so I left that marriage also. And when my son was 3 years old, I got a wonderful opportunity with the company that I was working for to learn some new skills, and so I moved to Fresno. And, you know, I was still doing the same thing. I was still looking for another him after I had left my husband. And I thought, well, things will be different. You know, I'll move to Fresno, and life will be different. We'll be able to start over again, and I'm sure none of you have ever done anything like that, but you know, it was just going to be a clean start. And it starts again. I started doing the same thing, except that it was with, you know, new faces, different people. When my son would go to Arizona to spend the summer with his dad or over Christmas vacation or whatever, I was never home. I was never home. And I did a lot of things that, you know, I was very ashamed of. And then when he would be there, because whatever him it was I was with was always, always more important than he was. When I listen to alcoholic women speakers talk about the shame and the anguish they feel over leaving their children at home while they wouldn't sit on a bar stool for a month, I can identify with that. Because it wasn't a drink I was chasing, it was a him I was chasing. And I would leave my son with people that I didn't really know all that well. And, you know, thank God nothing bad ever happened to him. But in the process, I met a guy that really hit my bottom with. I was willing to do a lot of things with him that I had not ever been willing to do in my life. I thought that those things were much below me, and I wasn't raised that way. You know, I was a good person, but I was willing to do things that I never thought I would do. And when that relationship ended, I went to see a counselor because I hit a real bottom, and I didn't know anything about Al-Anon, and I didn't know anything about alcoholism either. And the counselor told me that I was a woman who loved too much. There was a book out that has that title on it, and it had just come out. And she told me, I want you to get that book, and I want you to read it. And she also said, I think you're probably an adult child of an alcoholic. And there is also a book out called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And she said, I want you to get that book, and I want you to read it. And I identified with all the stories in both of those books. And that was my problem. I just loved people way too much. And I saw her for quite a while. I didn't, single mom, I didn't have a lot of money, so I did what I could, and then she started a therapy group of other women that were like me, and she didn't charge us anything. That was a real, godsend because I just couldn't afford it. And, I stayed in that therapy group for a long time, and my life changed a little bit. It changed a little bit. And I got involved in another relationship. This guy, I was over at a friend's apartment, and her next-door neighbor walked over, and then he rang the doorbell, and she answered the door, and I was like, oh, my God. He had this look about him that was, I just need somebody to fix me. And I just melted. And he ended up being husband number three. And, you know, things were good for a while. He was very, very insecure. He just needed the love of a good woman to bolster him up and make him feel like a man. And I was that person. I could do that. And I knew I could do that. And I took that job on. And unfortunately, you know, this is a guy, he is an alcoholic, and I can say that because he has said that. And this is a guy that has a lot more than alcoholism as a problem. And instead of being abused in that relationship, I became the abuser. I was not physically abusive, but I was very verbally abusive and emotionally abusive. And he allowed me to do that because he was very, he just didn't know how to stand up to people. And 3 weeks, about 6 weeks before we got married, he had a DUI. And I really didn't want to go through with the wedding. I loved him, but I knew getting married probably wasn't the best thing. And when he called from jail, and he was crying and everything, and he said, you know, you need to go find somebody else. I'm not good enough. You know, I was like, oh, no, it'll be all right. We'll take care of it. And I was pissed because I'll tell you what, I had to spend the money for my wedding ring to bail him out. And I was not very happy about that. But his parents had already spent a lot of money on our wedding. I couldn't ask my parents to spend any money because here's the third time and I'm not going to ask them to spend any money. And his parents had already spent a lot of money. I'd already had a couple of bridal showers and, you know, people had bought these gifts. And I, you know, getting married, I just knew wasn't right, but it was more important to me how you felt. And I was going to go ahead and go through with this marriage because I couldn't send back all those presents. I couldn't say I'm not going to do this because then you would be upset with me. All those people would be upset with me. We went ahead and we got married, and, you know, things just went from bad to worse. When my son was 11 and a half years old, we decided he wanted to go back to Arizona and live with his dad. And again, because how he felt about me and how he cared about me was more important than what I knew was the best place for him to be, I said, go ahead and go. And, you know, the way I was at that time, I raged. I would just fly off the handle of anything. I would have wanted to leave too. You know, I wasn't comfortable. I didn't like it there. But I didn't know what else to do. And after he left, he was, I'd call him on the phone and I couldn't understand why he talked to me the way he did. He wasn't, you know, he was not the kid that I had with me. He was somebody else and I didn't understand that. And he was coming back for Christmas vacation. So I went to see a counselor again. I went to see a therapist. And she helped me to understand what was going on with this kid. And, but, you know, they never stop where you want to just, you know, look at. They got to dig a little bit deeper. And she told me that I was probably married to an alcoholic. And I knew that because My husband could go all week long without drinking, but the weekends were awful. The weekends he would get up and he would start drinking or he'd start smoking dope, and it was all weekend long until, you know, Monday morning when he went back to work, or Monday night when he went back to work. And so anyway, I went to see her for a few times. My son came. The 2 weeks that he was there were really bad. Were really bad. Because I knew that he was 12 years old now, and I had a real 12-year-old and an adult that had the, you know, emotional age of about 12 also. And I had to do something about that. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I'll tell you, I had gotten to the point in my life where both homicide and suicide were way up on the list. You know, I didn't want to go through another divorce, and we would go out into the foothills east of Fresno, and he would target shoot with his .22, and I would think of ways that I could kill him with that gun and nobody ever find out about it and get back to town, you know, without me ever being there. And then I would also think of ways to kill myself. I would be driving home at night from work, and I would drive down the street where you could go pretty fast, and, you know, I'd think about wrapping my car around the telephone pole. And anyway, after my son left, I went to see that therapist one more time, and she was a very, very wise therapist. She said, you know, you don't need to see me. She said, I think that if you would just go to Al-Anon and you would get a sponsor and you would start working the steps, she said, I think your life will change. And I followed direction pretty good, and I did that. I didn't do it that night. I tried to do it that night, and there was, I called the Al-Anon hotline. They told me where a newcomer's meeting was that night. Since I was going to be a newcomer, well, that's the meeting I've got to go to, right? So I tried finding it, but it was just pouring buckets of rain, and I couldn't find the address. So I waited a whole week to the next Thursday, because that's the only newcomers meeting, and that's the one I've got to go to. So I waited, and I went to that meeting. And I went to the meeting that I was supposed to go to for the first time, because when I walked in that meeting, a couple people were celebrating a year's birthday, and yeah, we have birthdays now and on also. I know many alcoholics say that we can't because we have slips on a daily basis, but in that meeting, the topic was fear and faith. Now, I didn't think I had a lot of fear. I had moved to Fresno all on my own with a 3-year-old, with no family. I would drive back to Arizona by myself with my son. I would chase him down in the bad parts of town at night. I didn't have any fear, but I heard real fear that night. I heard what real fear was, and I had a lot of it. And I had a belief in God, because when I was growing up, my parents sent my sister and I to Sunday school. We didn't go to church. My parents didn't go to church, but they made sure my sister and I got some kind of education. And so I had a belief in God, but I knew I had no faith. And what I heard there was hope. I heard that these two people, they shared, and they had been in the program for a year, and I heard how their life had changed in that year. And, you know, I didn't go to Al-Anon to learn how to get him sober. I went to Al-Anon because my life was a mess, and I needed some help somewhere. And I thought, if these two people can have that kind of hope after a year, maybe there's something here for me. After a couple of weeks, that therapist said, you got to get a sponsor. So I went up to the secretary of the meeting, and I said, I need to get a sponsor. How do I do that? She said, well, there's one lady in the meeting here that can sponsor people. And so she pointed her to me, and I went over, and I talked to her, and I was talking to her about, you know, a sponsor. And she was just shaking her head, yes, you know, like this. What she was doing was she was waiting for me to ask her to be my sponsor. And I said, I finally figured that out. And she was the person that I needed at that time. She's not my sponsor today, but she was the person that I needed when I came into the program, because even though she's the age of my mother, she reminded me of my grandmother. And she loved me unconditionally. There was a time when I called her and I asked her if we could meet. I was having some problems, and so we met at a coffee shop, and I just couldn't stop crying. And she said, let's go out and sit in the car. So we went out and we sat in the car, and I am just crying. I got snot coming out of my nose, and this woman just held me to her chest. She didn't care that I'm getting all this stuff all over her. She just loved me. She just loved me in a way I had never known. And, you know, I am so grateful that she was there in my life at that time. I heard in the program that you don't make any changes after 6 months, because I was wanting to leave that husband. I was wanting to get out of that marriage. And so when 6 months came, I said, okay, you're out the door, buddy. And, you know, I wasn't ready for that, because I had this illusion that then he was going to date me and court me and he was going to change. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. So we got back together, and I just kept working on myself. And he would go out fishing at night. On the nights that he didn't work, he'd go fish, and he'd go about 30, 40 miles up into the foothills to this lake. And I always knew that he was drinking and smoking dope when he was up there. Before I came into Al-Anon, I would go to sleep at night when he'd go on his fishing excursions, but I couldn't stay asleep. And I'd wake up about 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd lay there waiting to hear that his truck come pull up in the driveway. And I also did the thing, you know, I'm sure if you're in Al-Anon, you can relate to this, where you go look out the window, because looking is going to make it appear. Never happened. But I would lay there and I would wait for him to come home. I wouldn't say anything, but I would just wait, because I couldn't go back to sleep. And the first night that I was able to sleep all night long, when we went on one of his fishing trips after I came into the program, it was like, oh my God, what a miracle. You know, I understood what the second step was. I had placed him in God's hands, not even knowing that I had done that. And I had let him go off on, you know, I didn't have any control over it, but, you know, he went off, and I was okay. I slept, and he was okay. You know, whatever was going to happen to him was going to happen to him, and there was nothing I could ever do about it. We did finally get a divorce. I didn't want to live the way that we were living. You know, he continued to drink. The speaker this afternoon, my sponsor would give me her tapes, because, you know, she had learned how to be happy whether the alcoholic was drinking or not. Oh, God, I clung on to those words. I clung on to those words so much that I could be happy. It didn't make any difference whether my husband was drinking or not. I could be okay. And I got to the point where I was okay. But I just didn't want to live that kind of life anymore. I wanted sobriety in my life. I wanted recovery in my life for both of us. And that's not what he wanted. My sponsor, I had changed sponsors, and that sponsor, she had a relationship that's what I wanted. She and her boyfriend, they would go off to conferences everywhere together. You know, they were the AA Al-Anon couple, and they looked good, and that's what I wanted. You know, I wanted that kind of relationship where we were sharing our lives instead of just an existence, because for me, that's what it was. And so we went ahead and we got a divorce. And I don't know where he is, and I don't know what he's doing, but I know that God's watching over him wherever he's at. And I pray that someday that he gets sobriety and that he gets some help in his life so that he can live a good, you know, happy life. I've had to do a lot of letting go, learning how to let go. One of the things I had to let go of, besides that marriage, was my son. I don't do teenagers well. I just don't do teenagers well. And he came one summer, and he was 14, and my dad had brought him, and he was not going to do anything. Anybody told him what to do. I was still married to my ex-husband, and he certainly wasn't going to do what he told him to do. And I said, I'm not going to live like this. And he, too bad. So I called my sponsor, and she said, send him home. Put him on a plane and send him home. I'm like, I can't do that. I've only had him here for a week. I can't do that. She said, do you want to live with this insanity in your house? Are you willing to accept this unacceptable behavior? And I said, no. She said, then put him on a plane and send him home. That was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I set that kid on that plane, and I thought for sure he was going to hate me. I just knew he'd never talk to me again. But the one thing I've learned in this program is that I have to let go of the things that I want in order to keep them. And I'm not going to tell you that the relationship that I have with him today is the best. It's better. It's a good relationship. But he has learned how to kind of manipulate me very well. And I taught him, I'm sure, that. And so one more time I've been told you have to let him go. And he has said to him, baby. And I love my grandchildren. I have two others. And being a grandma is one of the best things in the world because, you know what, I get to try to do it a little bit different this time. And I have to let him go. Because he's using that baby to rip my heart out one more time. But you know what, I can have a relationship with him at a distance until I can learn how to do it so that my heart doesn't get ripped out and that he's not able to kind of manipulate me anymore. And I can have a relationship with her, with his girlfriend, and love her because I do. She's a real sweetheart. And I can keep track of how that baby's doing. I got married again. I guess you know that because if you were here last night, you heard me out. And that has been a real blessing in my life. I knew Matt as a friend. I've been real active in service, and he says, you always forget to talk about your service. So while I'm thinking about it, I better say something about my service, because I always forget about it. Early in my recovery, my first sponsor, she had me go to a recovery center and talk to the family groups. And oh, gosh, I'm like, well, what do I have to share? I've only been in the program for about 6 months. I said, I don't have anything to offer these people. I said, I've got a husband who's still at home drinking. She said, you have a lot to offer these people because only about 1 in 10 of them is going to stay sober. And their family members need to know that they have a place to go to, that they have a place that they can be all right, whether their significant other goes back out and starts drinking and using again. And so I went, and I didn't share very much, but I'll tell you that set off the type of obsession for me in service work that I just love. I started going out I wanted to know about going into the prisons, especially women's prisons. We have the two largest ones, I think, in the United States, in the Central Valley, about 30 miles north of Fresno. They sit on one's on one corner and the other one's on the other corner. And I wanted to go out there. I wanted to start Al-Anon meetings out there. And so I had been involved in an H&I conference on the Al-Anon side that was in Fresno, so I got to know some of the guys in AA that were on the H&I committee, and I said, how do we do this? How do we go about starting an Al-Anon meeting in a facility? And so they said, well, you know, why don't you go out to one of the AA meetings and see how it's done. So I got, I went out to Avenal, which is quite a distance from Fresno, and it was in the summertime, and it's out in the middle of nowhere, and I had never been in a prison before. And you go in, and you go inside those gates, and there's all that electric wire and everything, and then you go inside of another gate, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in here now. And so I go into the AA meeting, and I'm just going to sit there, just watch what they're doing. You know, the inside sponsors, like, you can sit over here with us, or you can go over and sit at the tables if you'd like to, and you know, listen to the inmates share. And my mind's going 100 miles an hour. There were so many flies, and they've got fly swatters with wire on them. And I've got my purse with my keys in it, and I've got a coffee pot with cords, and my mind is just thinking of all these awful things that if these inmates decide they want to do something, they could do. And I'm just going 100 miles a minute inside my head, and then all of a sudden I said, okay, God's right there. You're all right. Everything's going to be fine. And, you know, my sponsor has taught me that an AA meeting is for people who identify as alcoholics. I'm not an alcoholic, so I don't care if I go to an AA meeting. But those inmates wanted to know who I was and what I was doing there. And so they asked me if I would tell them what Al-Anon was. They didn't know what it was. So I shared with them what Al-Anon was and just a little bit about me. Well, on the other side of the room was a Spanish-speaking only meeting, AA meeting. And they wanted to know who I was. So I went over there and they did a translator, and I felt like I was doing sign language and everything, and they translated, and I had some, I don't know why, I'd taken some meeting lists with me, but they had the 800 numbers for the World Service Office, and they took them because, of course, in California, they, you know, we have meetings everywhere. But I was able to start going out to Chowchilla Women's Prison, which is, that's not the name of it, but it's in Chowchilla. And we don't have meetings there. They don't understand about Al-Anon. If you drink or you use drugs or you've been beaten up by your spouse or whatever, they understand that. So they have lots of room for AA meetings. They have lots of room for NA meetings. They have lots of room for battered women's meetings. But they don't understand about Al-Anon because if that person that just got sober or they just stopped using drugs, then your life would be all right. So, you know, what's that program all about? They just don't comprehend. And so there's no place for us out there. So what we do is we go in once every 6 weeks. They have a regular school there, and one of the classes is on alcohol and drug education. And the women are in there, are all volunteers. They go to that class voluntarily. It is not to get them sober or clean. It's just to educate them. And some of the women that are in there belong in Al-Anon. They're in that class because someone that they love is an alcoholic. And so we go out there and we share with those ladies about Al-Anon and the family disease of alcoholism. And it is just one of the best things in my recovery that I do because I identify with those women. But by the grace of God, I didn't end up in that place. You know, I was doing things that I could have been there. And, you know, I share that with them every single time, you know. I deserve to be there, but I'm not. And, you know, we've had ladies come up to us after we did them sharing and tell us, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, but my family members are. I worked with a woman who embezzled from the company I was working at because her husband was an active alcoholic and her daughter was in all kinds of trouble. And he wasn't working. There was active alcoholism in that home. That's why she ended up in prison. You know, and people that say this is not a family disease, they're crazy. They are absolutely crazy. Anyway, I was involved in this conference for the H9, and I met Matt. And I was still married at the time, and Matt and I just became buddies. You know, every once in a while he'd give me a phone call, ask me how I was doing, we'd talk about recovery. And I thought he was, you know, I thought he was a nice guy, but I was married. And so my husband and I decided to get a divorce. And I was, I don't know, I was doing some service work in Al-Anon, and Matt happened to be there, and I went over, said hi to him, he asked me how I was doing. I said, I'm doing pretty good. I said, I finally decided to get a divorce. My telephone started ringing an awful lot. Now, he'll probably tell you that's not true, but that's the way it happened. And, you know, God gave me the ability to learn how to love Matt through these conversations, these long conversations that we would have over the telephone, because I didn't think that I could love somebody that looks the way that Matt looks. You know, I'm a very shallow person, and but because we'd have these long conversations over the telephone, and a lot of them had to do with God, I was able to love him, learn to love him for who he is on the inside and not about what he looks like. That has been one of the best gifts that I have gotten. I have learned to see people differently. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that it has been a wonderful marriage. We have struggled. We have struggled a lot. But today, we are married. Just today. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, and whatever happened yesterday has happened, and today we are married. And as long as I can take my marriage one day at a time, I can stay there. He stood up here and told you last night that he'd been married. I'm his eighth wife. Well, he's my fourth husband. We don't do marriages well. And I went to a retreat this October, and Sister V, I don't know if any of you know who she is, but she was the retreat leader, and she said, you know, we all go into relationships with baggage. Some of us have a backpack, and some of us have a U-Haul. And I said, I got a moving truck, a big one. So, you know, when I keep what's going on in perspective, anything, whether it's my marriage, my career, if I keep it in perspective of today, I can do it. You know, Matt told you last night that 3 weeks before we got married, my dad died. In 9 months, we lost three of our parents. I had an uncle that was murdered in that 9 months, and I had another uncle that died of cancer, and we had several friends that died. It was probably one of the toughest years in my life I had ever been through. And before we went back to Arizona to bury my dad and to make all the arrangements with my sister, I told God that the most important thing for me to do when I left there was to make sure that I still had a relationship with my sister, because it's a very shaky one. And I wanted to make sure that when I left there, I didn't leave there with material things, but I left there with my sister. And things went pretty good most of the week. God had really done a wonderful job at putting my dad's life in order before he died. He had sold his home. His little dog had died. His bills were all paid off. I mean, everything was we couldn't have asked for it to be any better than it was. And at the funeral, my dad was a veteran, and so they, you know, draped his coffin with a flag, and they did the honor guard thing, and they folded the flag up, and they gave it to the oldest. So the spouse, of course, my parents were divorced, so they gave it to the oldest spouse, which was me. And they started to hand the flag to my sister because she looks older than I did. And she got really upset. She was and I knew she was, you know, but that upset her a lot. Because, see, she had been there. She had been there to help my dad. He would get congestive heart failure, and she would be there to help take care of him. I wasn't there. And, you know, she had said she wanted his wedding ring, and she wanted this, and she wanted, that was fine. And I wanted to take that flag home. And she got really upset because I asked for that. And I probably didn't ask him in probably the best way. And she left her house, and I knew she was really angry. And so I was talking to Matt about it, and I said, you know, that's quite right. And he said, well, maybe you owe her an amends. And I don't really like being told that, especially by my husband. And so the next morning, when we got up, I was going to go out there, and I was going to tell her that I was really sorry for the way that I had said what I had said. And, you know, that's basically about all I was going to say. But what I did is I walked outside. They were sitting outside on the patio smoking a cigarette. And I said, Linda, I probably didn't say what I said last night about the flag quite right. And if it means a lot to you, I'd really like for you to keep it. I'm like, where did those words come from? But, you know, I went home with a relationship with my sister. There's material things that mean anything. I could go down and buy a flag and say it was the one that was draped up on my dad's coffin. How would I know? I mean, you know, who would know? It doesn't make any difference. But it was more important for me, and I know that that's what my dad would have wanted, was for me to go home with that relationship. And we still don't talk a lot, but, you know, it's there. It's there. My recovery process, sometimes things move a little bit slow and sometimes they move a little bit fast. I kind of like it when things are moving along because then I'm not stuck in the pain so much. But then I get a little complacent and then the pain creeps up because I start doing things that I know are not that healthy for me. And so I got to start doing things a little bit different. I told you that I believed in God when I came into the program, but I had no faith. And today I have a relationship with God that I thought I would never have. This last year has been, spiritually, has been quite an experience for me. There were things that I never thought that I would commit to in my spiritual life. Things that I never thought were quite true. And that I would be willing to commit to. And that has changed for me this year. And it's been an awesome, awesome experience for me. I have to say that today I am very pleased with Peggy. I like who she is. I continue to grow on a daily basis. There are things in my life that make me grow. If I am uncomfortable about something, then I know I need to grow. I'm not going to stand up here and be a holy roller and spout the Bible to you or anything like that because that's not what's done at a podium for Al-Anon. But there is a story that I can relate to in the Bible. And it has to do with the disciples being in a boat out on the sea. And Jesus is walking. And he calls to them to go and walk with him on the water. And Peter is the only one that gets out of the boat to walk on the water. And a strong wind comes up, and his faith falters, and he gets scared, and he starts to sink. And Christ reaches out his hand, and he said, just have faith, just believe. And I know that that's all that I need to do in my life every day is believe that God is there and that he will walk with me and I can walk on that water with him if I so choose. When I get in fear, because that's what that is, when I get in fear, I remember that story because I'm a very visual person and I can relate to that. So I just reach my hand out, and I know that my God is there, and he is walking with me, and thank you very much.